Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-host, Laura Chan Baker.
Hello.
Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action, in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Each week, we come together in the sweatbox that is our recording studio and dissect three different links we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as jumping off points to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we start the fourth season of our podcast, and it's the first episode of the season, and we delve into such meaty subjects as the controversial Firefox rebrand, anonymous reporting on artist payments, and the dreaded imposter syndrome. Helping us bring some outside perspective today is our special guest and Jackie Winter artist, Andrew Fairclough. Andrew is an Australian illustrator, designer, and typographer based in LA. After a misspent youth completing a business degree, Andrew moved on to designing skate and snowboard graphics in between bouts of self-instruction and full-time work in a design agency in his hometown of Sydney. Andrew's work is inspired by mid-century spot illustrations and design, as well as vintage sci-fi, comics, surrealism, DIY art culture, and the textural wonders of degraded print. For many other designers and illustrators, Andrew might be more well-known as the founder and creative behind the True Grit Texture Supply Co., the business he established in 2015 out of his love for all things texture and is now a thriving business in its own right. Andrew, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Andrew, it's so exciting to have you here. We've all missed you so much since you left the country. And of course, I was lucky enough to get to catch up with you just late last year. And you guys brought me very sleep deprived to your lovely place there in Venice. Is it Venice?
Yeah, Venice.
In Venice, and sort of took me around for the day. And I really appreciate it. And it's so nice to catch up with you. And it's really nice to catch up with you again. So thank you. Thank you for joining us. And also, you're a listener of the show, aren't you, Andrew?
I am occasionally, yes.
You know, we've been planting little Easter eggs in like every episode, hoping that you've been listening and picking up on them.
And I know, and it's funny because in like doing my background research, as you do this week, I listened to the episode with Fashgif, and I was like, oh my God, they gave me a little mention there. That was quite funny. So yes, I'm a sometimes listener.
We'll change that.
Yeah. I do like to troll you with a little email references to the episode from time to time, which is good fun.
We like the emails a lot. Jeremy, how are you going?
You know, like, whatever. I've had glandular fever, which like people only get like usually when they're, you know, 13 in America. Yeah. That's called the kissing disease.
I don't like being locked in this room with you when you have a contagious disease. But well, anyway.
Yeah. I think as a teenager, you get it from kissing. And as an adult, you get it from changing nappies, which is pretty relevant. Been doing a lot of that. But yeah, we have been off for the past 3 weeks. We've been refining and honing, you know, our structure, booking in some amazing guests for the next season. I'm so happy to be back in here. I have so many good links to talk about. Like even choosing them for this week was so hard. So I think there's some amazing developments that have been happening in the industry. We have some amazing guests that have been booked. Laura, you've been doing a fantastic job on that. So I'm just happy to be back.
You know what? So am I. I'm happy to be back. I missed it. The 2 weeks went quick, but I missed it. And it's just good to be back in here with you guys talking about this stuff. And you're right. We have a lot of links, so we should probably just dive into them. Who's kicking it off?
You are, actually. Yes.
Awesome. I will do that. Okay. So good to be back, you guys. This came to me via Jeremy's favorite, once again, Fast Company. Basically, what's going on is Firefox redesigning their logo. I assume everyone knows Firefox, right? You know, the web browser by Mozilla that we sort of all used to use before Chrome was a thing. Some people are now making a jump back to it. Apparently, it's really good if you're into privacy. Okay, cool. Basically, instead of sort of pulling a London 2012 Olympics and releasing a logo that sort of causes laughter and hatred to ripple across the globe, they've taken a bit of a different approach, and they're asking the public to comment on the design options before they finalize their decision. And I have to point out here that Fast Company phrased this as Firefox giving its community the opportunity to comment, which I think is kind of a funny way to put it, given the opportunity here is really one for Firefox, not for the public. But anyway,
what do you mean?
It's not an opportunity for the community to be involved. It's an opportunity for Firefox to get feedback. It's not like they're giving their community something wonderful.
Aren't they, though, in a way?
Let me continue.
Okay.
Anyway, from what I can tell, it was originally being handled by Johnson Banks, who was the branding agency who did their big overhaul in 2016.
The Mozilla overhaul.
Yeah. But it seems that these new designs have actually been created internally by a team of designers at Firefox. So there are two logo systems being presented here with a bit of a new approach to their logo hierarchy. So each system has a master logo, which is designed to represent more than just the browser, but sort of Firefox as a whole, as a larger company who's producing an array of apps and services. And then underneath each master logo sits a subsuite of sub-logos that represent these other elements, which of course, you know, could be built upon in the future. And both systems do actually maintain some reference to the brand's sort of well-known Fox character, but both sort of take this into a more on-trend, like 2018 kind of vibe. So for those playing at home who haven't seen these yet or who aren't listening to this using Pocket Cast or Overcast, remember, if you are, you can see all sorts of enhanced visual content as we talk. So I'll just describe them really quickly. The first suite of logos is very, I don't know, millennial. It features a sort of like geometric stylized version of a fox's head in a palette of like bright orange, yellow, magenta, and all the secondary logos sit within this same geometric style. As a side note, it's kind of interesting to see that gradients are making a comeback in icon and web design. Like, I remember when they were like sort of considered the devil for a while, it was like all flat, everything. Anyway, just interesting. And the second suite is definitely more of a nod to their current logo. So it sort of maintains that orange fire swell, but it removes the actual fox head for the master logo. It's more just fire. But this is brought back for the logo specifically to be used for the browser. So the other secondary logos, I don't know why, but they almost feel a little like Windows to me. I can't really put my finger on it though. Now, in their words, Firefox has stated, living by our open source values of transparency and participation, we're reaching out to our community to learn what people think. You can make your views known by commenting on this blog post below. And then before they launch into things, they include a few caveats and also the criteria by which they'd like people to judge the work by, which I mean, is very hopeful given that I don't know if people on the internet are going to actually read and abide by criteria, but they have listed as an extreme caveat, although the products and projects are real, these design systems are still a work of fiction. Icons are not final. Each individual icon will undergo several rounds of refinement or may change entirely between now and their respective product launches. Our focus at this point is on the system, which to me, I had to laugh because it feels so much like me when I try to like really, really clearly tell a client that what they're seeing is rough development and that we're like only looking at composition, not final rendering. And then of course, like they always come back with like, why isn't it red? You know, why isn't it moving? Anyway, so what I wanted to ask you guys, I mean, at the beginning of their post, they sort of clarify these three things. One, we are not crowdsourcing the answer. Two, there will be no voting. Three, no one is being asked to design anything for free. So I just want to know, like, what do you guys think? Is this a valuable exercise? Jeremy, would you ever do this with Jackie Winter?
Oh, this is so interesting, actually. I mean, one of the links that I was actually going to pick for a future episode, and I still might kind of go into, is this motion graphics company went to three different outsourcing communities to do a piece of motion graphics. So they did like one through Fiverr for $7, one for Upwork for $150, and one through a professional designer for $1,000. And they went through the result. And like, you know how you get spam all the time about, we'll redesign your website or redo your logo. I was like, oh man, I would love to do this and kind of see what the results are. And someone actually did it, which is cool. We'll talk about that maybe on a future episode. But I think this is such an interesting, this whole article, this whole thing is really interesting. And I mean, I don't think it would work for anyone else other than a company like Mozilla or Firefox or something that's kind of so synonymous with the internet. I mean, I think doing research like as a part of any kind of redesign process is really kind of important. And, you know, as we're learning kind of ourselves, we're going through a similar process. And I think, well, what better way to do that on the internet than by the actual users of your product? And they're right there in the browser. So it seems kind of very harmonious. At the same time, it's an amazing content marketing play in terms of getting press for Mozilla and for Firefox. I think it's interesting kind of what you said as well in terms of how gradients are making a bit of a comeback. And I think that has a lot of technical advancement kind of behind that. I think as web technology has evolved, especially kind of with different animation and different CSS techniques and things like that, you know, now you can actually have kind of gradients in your work where you might not have had it before, where it had to kind of be vectored to keep file sizes down. So it's really interesting to see. I went back to kind of one of the original posts from 2004 from Hicks Design. He did kind of the, well, like I guess what you would kind of consider the Firefox logo today. And I just remember that was just so, so fresh, you know, and then like everything kind of needed to be kind of like that in this way. This was kind of the original Fox kind of.
I still like their original logo, even though it is like, it's a little bit dated. I still like I have a warm spot for it.
It's really strong. And the fact that it's lasted kind of this long, actually, I mean, I was amazed. I was in 2004. I mean, that's over a decade ago. And like, you know, that style was kind of still kind of really fresh. But I think the kind of, I don't know, like, I don't know what good could kind of come out of this process. Like, it's kind of like they're trying to get ahead of themselves by making the thing, putting it out there, obviously putting it out there for comment, and then I don't know, like, if they're, how you're going to kind of take all that feedback on board, because we use Brand New, the site from Under Consideration, as a lot of kind of our corresponding links for other identity projects. And nobody's ever in the same mind about things. There's always such kind of rabid conflict online, and opening up the commenters, no matter kind of how high-minded you are, you're going to get such strong opinions on either side. So
would you do this for Jackie Winter? Would you ever, let's say we have a, we're opening a new roster or whatever, we need a new logo for it. Would you ever ask anyone for their opinion? Like, we'll ask the public, not asking specific people.
In a design sense, I don't know. Like, I would like to think that I would have the kind of confidence to just kind of roll with kind of what we kind of felt was best. I don't know. I mean, and it did generate, this piece has generated a lot of comments, like, you know, almost 2,000. Andrew, did you have a read through the comments at all? Or did you formulate your own opinion here?
Well, you know, I enjoy scrolling through the dumpster fire that is any comment section on the internet. So, yeah, I had a look through there, you know, like I was kind of thinking of this quite analytically, I guess, like looking at it from the point of view of, you know, a creative team or even an individual creative, you know, how, like, would I want my work to be put out for public vote like this? But once you actually kind of start analyzing the work as a public commentator, it's difficult not to get kind of drawn into it and like, oh yeah, I really agree with, you know, commenter 1, 2, 3 and their thoughts on this particular aspect of it or whatever. So yeah, I mean, I was quite surprised to see that there wasn't any really savage commentary on there. It's not like...
It didn't feel like the internet.
No, it did not. And I mean, it's interesting, Jeremy, that you say, you know, you talk about Brand New, because like I really do, that was kind of what I expected, the whole kind of, you know, those that can do, those that can't write nasty comments about other people's work in the comment section of Brand New, you know, and there was none of that. It was actually, a lot of it was quite constructive, respectful, and I maybe smell a rat in that sense. Like, it does make me think, has this thread been sanitized? Because it really does seem a little bit too respectful, but like, great, it gives me great hope for the internet in that sense.
I think it brings up some really interesting ideas that I'm surprised kind of weren't explored. I mean, mostly the conversation is about, I like number one, I like number two. Like, I don't know, like, I didn't see too much kind of depth of conversation there. But it kind of reminds me, looking at the two things next to each other, this idea of these kind of older skinning programs. Like, I think the real popular one for Mac was kind of Candy Bar, or, you know, people kind of design their own kind of app icons in these different sets, and you could kind of, you know, apply it to kind of all your apps to kind of get a different kind of feeling from it. Like, that's kind of what it felt, kind of just like a bit retro to me in this kind of way, that you could, well, I don't know, maybe you could have a company like Firefox develop all these kind of different types of identities, and people can kind of pick and choose them and apply them in a kind of a different way. I don't know, like, if it's kind of a matter of just kind of picking one or the other.
My just have to quickly add, as I always do, my favorite comment. This is from Greg. And he said, System One browser icons feel very wrong, like it's a weird tadpole sperm creature.
Of course.
Greg bringing the goods. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it kind of just, I think, you know, for us as producers, like, when we get kind of feedback from lots of people, like, I just kind of think it never is a good thing, you know? It's kind of like, there's always
too many cooks.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. Andrew, how would you feel about if a client turned to the public for feedback on an illustration that you were creating for them?
Horrified. I think as any illustrator or artist would be. I was kind of thinking about this, and this is a very different thing to say, you know, somebody's editorial illustration or advertising illustration or whatever being kind of put out for public commentary. You know, presumably the team involved in this, you know, they're either on salary or they're, you know, they're at least getting paid quite well. There was a lot of work that has gone into this. It's kind of, you know, 3/4 of the way there. There's clearly been a very concise brief written, and, you know, to an extent, you know, they're presenting two options. It's not like they're like, hey, here's our 50 Illustrator files. What do you guys think? And then like throwing it out to a focus group or whatever. So, you know, like, in a sense, I think there's kind of, you know, there's a predetermined outcome here a little bit. And it does feel, it's very on brand, but it feels a little bit tokenistic.
You know, you're someone who kind of works by commission as well, but you also kind of sell creative products and to the public in more of kind of a retail sense. That must open you up to so much types of feedback in terms of like people are like, yeah, like I wish you would do this thing or I wish you'd do that thing. I know that Basecamp, for example, they're kind of notorious for working very slowly, only rolling out kind of certain small features kind of in sprints, and they've kind of developed a certain somewhat confrontational relationship with their customers by not developing features and kind of ignoring them at the same time.
Jeremy's got a relaxed grin there. There's some personal stuff within that.
What, I mean, is that something that you experience, like in terms of like the level of feedback, and how do you manage it within True Grit as a business?
I mean, this kind of comes back to the respectfulness thing, and like most people are really, really respectful and really positive in their feedback. And it's like, hey, I just want to let you know, like I bought this brush set and I love it. It's really awesome. I couldn't figure this out. Like, and I just wanted to let you know that because like it just didn't quite do what I thought. So maybe you need to tweak it here or there or something like that. And like, that's about it. And it's really helpful a lot of the time because, you know, you cannot possibly test every single aspect of a product release. And, you know, I was reading this really interesting article by Scott Bilski from Behance, 99U founder, yesterday talking about how like launch in beta, don't spend 2 years perfecting the product, spend 6 months getting it almost there and discover the problems with it, like allow your users to point out the problems with it or the workflows that could be a little better or whatever. So I kind of try and do that, you know, and like get it 70% of the way there and then just press go and hope for the best, and people will let you know very quickly if something's not working. So
that's very true.
They generally tend to be very respectful about it. And honestly, I've had like in the space of 3 years, two really upset kind of trolls or people who've sent me very offensive emails. But, you know, like the other 2,000 emails I've received have been very, very positive. So it's generally pretty good.
The overall agile approach like that is used by software developers is something that I think creatives could take a huge leaf out of. I talk about it a lot, and I've been talking to a lot of our artists about their folios now and about how it's really important to kind of consistently be working on your style and updating what you do. And sometimes like that can be interpreted as like, I have to wait 3 years until I develop a whole new body of work. But I think, no, you can just kind of keep experimenting and do kind of one thing at a time and kind of slowly, you know, develop new bodies of work while your existing stuff is out there. And so to that end, I think it's interesting that Mozilla and Firefox is kind of sharing their process in this way. I think, again, if it was any other company, I'd have a much more cynical outlook. But no, it's an interesting article. So thanks for bringing it up, Laura.
You are welcome.
Moving on to our second link. Oh, this is a bit of a spicy one. This has been in my open tabs for the last kind of 2 weeks. It was initially something I found on Facebook, and it's, I don't know how to pronounce it because it's Artslog. I don't know if it's Art Slog.
Like, that's the gag, Jeremy.
Or if it's, oh, is it a gag?
I don't know. That's what I assumed.
Okay.
It's, well, a pun. It's Arts Log, Art Slog.
A log about arts or art being a slog. It could be either thing. Either way, it's a very professionally designed site where it's a platform for anyone who is an arts worker. And this is primarily in Australia. And they can basically, it's, well, how they describe it is these stories have been submitted by artists living and working in Australia. Each story is a collection of thoughts and experience and memories from one person's point of view. And then they say if they want to provide further information on the story, contact us. But the majority of the stories are complaints or whinges, or, I mean, there are a few kind of positive experiences kind of mixed in there. And there's maybe about 50 of them so far. And, oh, man, it's, I don't even know where to kind of come at this at, because the reason this is on my mind, because so many things are kind of happening in this space, especially for, I guess, anonymous parties to be voicing complaints, and especially for, like, you know, calling out harassers and other, you know, people who are in the Me Too movement, especially. And I think closest to us, we have the Diet Madison Avenue account, which I don't know, Laura, if you've been keeping on top mm-hmm. of that, but big news there that they, one of the kind of creative directors who was kind of targeted and lost his job over there has kind of sued them. And now I think requesting to have all their identities unmasked, and that it's apparently
that was granted, I believe.
It was granted, but I don't know if it's actually kind of been done, and it's turned out to be kind of between 15. They said it's 15 people with like 45 associates. So it's a big Whoa. Deal on this kind of Instagram account. And we're also kind of, you know, I think as producers and agents, you know, something like a big part of our work is trying to make sure that our artists aren't being engaged kind of fairly, and, you know, working on educational platforms, especially kind of online, is something that we're trying to do at the moment as well. And I'm really kind of feel a lot of conflict about this, because I feel that like some of these are genuine complaints of people being like, you know, radically undervalued, underpaid, or genuinely exploited. But mixed in there are kind of some, they feel to me like on the edge of kind of being, well, I don't know if their assertion is kind of correct or their kind of interpretation of it is correct. And then furthermore, then there's this whole idea that they're actually naming businesses and naming, I don't think they're naming individuals, but they are naming kind of businesses. They're putting kind of dollar amounts in there that we just have to assume kind of are true. So, oh God, like I feel so kind of conflicted about this. And I really just kind of, I don't know if I have kind of a definite opinion here. I really just kind of want to open up to talk to other people about it. And so, yeah, I just like, Laura, what were your thoughts?
Oof, I mean, yeah, you're right. It's a tricky one. I think, you know, people would assume that like we would immediately be on board with something like this because we are such staunch advocates for artists' rights. But I think in reality, for me anyway, I think that these sites can sometimes do more damage than good. So I do tread carefully. And as you're saying, there are various sites like these. I know that we've talked about a similar one on the podcast before.
The Shit List, I think it was called.
Yes.
And that's where people could kind of report clients who were delinquent in payment.
Yes. I was trying to find the episode where we talked about that. And I like, seriously, I'll $10 for anyone out there who can find it, because I could not figure it out. But anyway, I mean, look, I definitely, I see, I understand, and I actually agree with, I guess, what the site has set out to do, like the larger idea behind it, you know, to raise awareness of the sort of often pathetic budgets and poor working conditions presented to artists, and to create a place for transparency and accountability for artists, you know, people who generally do work alone and therefore don't have the benefits of learning this sort of information through the traditional structures of company employment. But I am really torn on the execution, I think, because on the one hand, you know, I can see the value and the necessity of including many voices in order to paint a realistic picture of the system and therefore sort of opening it up to the public. But on the other hand, I also think it would be more beneficial to consult a wide range of specific people who have solid experience and understanding of the area, and this is like, instead of just doing this, like publish proofed, vetted, fact-checked information and advice on how to tackle these things, rather than just sort of taking a range of anonymous opinions and presenting them as fact. And I think like the problem is that reading through these complaints, for the most part, you don't actually get a proper sense of, as you were saying, whether their complaint is valid or any of the context surrounding the commission in question. And I think that can be really dangerous, because then everything is left open to interpretation. And I think you have to keep in mind that I'm making an assumption here, but I think most likely it's sort of more inexperienced artists who are looking to sites like this for information on how to charge and handle clients. And the lens through which they might be interpreting these things is not one that is yet fully developed with an understanding of the industry and its complexities. I feel almost like this should be sort of part one of the project. Like there's this whole sort of fact-finding stage, and then they take those responses and use it to figure out, okay, what sort of information and help do artists need, and then develop that alongside people with clear industry experience and knowledge.
I think those are some really amazing points there.
But like, I just have to say that, like, I feel, again, that said, all of that said, I feel really torn, because I have so many anecdotes that I could add to this site about crap budgets or contracts. And like, seriously, I'm frustrated. Jeremy, you know this as well. You know, I'm frustrated almost every single week by another sort of rude, disrespectful proposal from someone who should know better. But, you know, the thing is, these things don't necessarily always rise out of a sort of evil, greedy client who's trying to like fuck over an artist. You know, more often than not, it is a lack of understanding. And as any person providing a service, it is our role and other artists' role to help educate them. And whilst I do think it's important to hold clients, and especially the big ones, accountable for the way that they behave in their interactions with artists, I don't think it's fair to name and shame anyone on the public stage unless there is a full understanding of the context in which it happened. And that includes all sorts of things like the type of work that was created, who the artist is, their relationship with the person or organization doing the asking, the purpose of the work, the way it was going to be used, who's going to benefit and how, and so much more.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah, and that's where I'm kind of drawn as well, is because like a lot of the, when you start digging into some of these, like everyone has says, you know, talks about how their time has value and that's been violated in some way. And like, that's like, yeah, like I'm the biggest proponent of that. But I think it is so complex and there's so much more to consider. And a few pieces especially call out people who've been asked to talk or do kind of lectures, maybe not lectures, but maybe talk or do a Q&A, and how that they were only offered a gift voucher or they were offered no fee. And like, you know, had some really vitriolic responses to that, where it's like, well, I mean, yeah, like you always had like, you know, maybe there's some other kind of value there. There is a lot of value in non-monetary transactions, like sometimes.
Absolutely.
And that has to be considered.
And it's a totally different thing if it's, let's say it's like a big corporate conference or it's a big heavily sponsored thing where they actually do make like a big profit. It's a business, you know, thing. But there are people calling out like talks they did at like a primary school and stuff. And I was like, are you kidding me? This is like, it's an educational thing. And if you don't want to donate your time, don't do it. That's totally fine. But
then,
I think it's
fine. And
then
mixed in there, someone kind of saying like, I was paid $100,000 to do the sculpture. It was great. They were a great client, you know?
I'm glad that there are the odd, like there's a few in there as well where people admit that they kind of exploited themselves, like that they shouldn't have said yes to things, or that they, I don't know, they kind of didn't put the blame on the client. They put the blame on themselves, which was kind of interesting to...
Oh, so many feels. Andrew, help me out here.
Help, I mean, Jeremy, help me.
Andrew, like we've spoken a lot about, you know, potentially between me and you, we've had a lot of issues where people have kind of taken your work and plagiarized it or used it without kind of permission. And we're like, man, it sucks that there's no public accountability out there. Like, how great would it be there to be a site that kind of named and shamed these people? So these are things that we have kind of talked about in a different way. So I'm really curious to hear from your perspective, like, you know, did you look at this? What was your gut feeling?
I just think it's a bit tepid, to be honest. Like, you know, I kind of agree with Lara. It's so all over the place. It's filled with like some artists' weird humble brags about getting paid $100,000 for a sculpture, and then other people who you can tell, you know, in their tone of voice that they know that they should never have taken this on. The name, the typesetting of the logo, is it Arts Log? Is it Art Slog? It's so cutesy. It's not angry enough. It's not vetted. It's a really good step in the right direction. I think this kind of thing is really important to get out there. But this just feels, I kind of feel a little bit bad for everyone involved in that, you know, if the idea of this is to kind of win hearts and minds a little bit, certainly from an outside perspective, or from a, you know, gallery perspective or industry perspective or general public perspective, it just kind of sounds like a bunch of artists crying, woe is me. Which, you know, it kind of, that, and that comment sounds really unfair because, you know, particularly...
Well, sometimes it's true. Sometimes woe is us.
Yeah, totally. Like, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, particularly in the fine arts and performing arts, like it's, you know, it's really difficult for people to make a living and get paid what they're worth and, you know, for their contribution to the, you know, cultural fabric of society to be recognized. So, you know, I am really torn, but I just, yeah, it's a tricky one.
Well, I think one thing that's important to mention here is that ArtsLog was commissioned for an exhibition called State of the Union, which is running at Ian Potter Museum of Art and the University of Melbourne. Yeah, it started running in July and it runs till October this year. And one thing that they mentioned on there, which is kind of interesting, is that during the exhibition, ArtsLog is going to pay artists the standard NAVA rates. Is it NAVA? Is that how you say it? Yeah. ArtsLog is going to be able to pay artists the standard NAVA rates to log their stories in person. So you visit the exhibition and you sort of clock on and off using like an employee timesheet system, and they're going to like cross-reference that with their entry or whatever, and then contact people to arrange payment after the exhibition closes, which is kind of, I don't know. The project's like supported by the Victorian government through Creative Victoria, which to me is just like, what are you doing, guys? And I think, you know, again, if the goal here was to help artists learn how to price their work in different markets or know what to look out for in a contract or even just to get, you know, a sense of the, you know, general consensus among artists, I still think this is sort of not really going about it in the right way. It doesn't really achieve those goals. It just kind of seems more like a Mean Girls like burn book that runs like a bit of a pretty dangerous risk of providing some kind of misleading information. But all that said, again, I am also very hesitant to discourage people from speaking out about unfair circumstances and bad behavior, because of course people shouldn't be silenced. And I do think it's important to call certain things out so that the rest of the freelance art industry doesn't sort of suffer in silence, thinking that there is no other way of doing things. And it is a really, it is an interesting tapestry in some way of people's experiences. But after thinking about this from all sides, I think I kind of, it's kind of like Zomato in the end. Like people only write in when they have something bad to say. Like no one writes a post to say like my meal was satisfactory at this restaurant. And totally. It's the same here. Like, you know, although the overwhelming majority are writing in with complaints, that doesn't necessarily reflect the state of the industry. Like no one's writing in to say like, I created some illustrations for a small business website and they paid me a sufficient amount, you know? But anyway, as I said, I'm torn.
I think, look, I mean, you mentioned Nava before. I think the work that they do in education is exemplary. And I think in terms of, you know, setting kind of standard rates, you know, talking about fair conditions for art workers and artists, things like that, I think they're doing fantastic work. And I think if you look in the About page, there's some really great resources there at the end. I think, yeah, my main kind of question is whether this kind of anonymous reporting is relevant and is healthy kind of for our industry. And I kind of, and that's kind of where
or
I'm
any
on the fence.
Industry.
Well, I don't know. Like, I mean, do you think that if, again, if you go back to the Me Too movement, like if there wasn't those systems in place for people to make these kind of reports anonymously, do you think we would have had as much progress as quickly? I mean, if you even admit that we have had any progress.
I think you're talking about quite different circumstances. That, like when talking about things like sexual harassment and assault and whatever is quite a different thing to like maybe being paid a little bit under what you think you should be.
But that's,
I don't know.
But that's kind of a line though. It's like, you know, what is the line between actual kind of exploitation and, you know, or kind of just kind of skirting the law a bit, you know, or kind of, you know, undervaluing kind of someone's work.
Jeremy, I slept like 3 hours last night. I can't answer that question.
I know.
Oh
but
my
that,
God.
That's the thing. It raises really big questions. And that's what I really kind of want to bring this up. So I encourage everyone to read this and have a look. If you have feedback, please let us know. We can talk about it next episode or put it up in our show notes. Yeah.
You can email us at podcast@jackiewinter.com.
I was getting to that before Laura rudely interrupted me. Yeah, I'm going to make a post on Artslog and kind of explain how I'm very harassed by my podcast co-host.
It's true. I do harass you.
And I think we will move on and round out to our third and final link today. Andrew, you come to us with something from 99U that you were speaking about Scott Belsky before. He was behind this blog, kind of part of Behance, now owned by Adobe. Before you get into this, tell us a bit more about your internet habits. How do you find links? How do you kind of keep on top of the world? Where do you look for inspiration? All that good stuff.
To be honest, I don't have a lot of time for it. And that sounds really ignorant, I guess, but...
No, it sounds like you have a life. We just don't have lives.
Well, it's not so much that. It's just like I'm a little bit overwhelmed by the volume of content out there. And at some point, you just have to kind of go, you know what? I'm going to stop worrying about what other people are doing and just get on with it myself. You know, and for that reason, you know, there's a handful of blogs that I kind of pay attention to. And, you know, 99U is one, and It's Nice That, and Fast Company, and like... I guess like all the usual suspects and then, you know, the odd Medium article that I come across, you know, I'm a member of a couple of different Slack channels. You know,
the
really
best
good.
One's the Jackie Winter Slack channel though,
yeah? Pretty good, I guess.
So tell us a bit more about this piece. I mean, where did you find it originally and why did you pick it?
Well, I actually found it a few years ago and then I read it and I was like, oh my God, this is so true. And then just in the last week or so, I came across it again randomly and completely forgot that I'd read it before.
And yeah, I do that all the time.
It just kind of spoke to me. I mean, the general gist of it is that, like, nobody knows, I mean, as the title says, nobody knows what the hell they are doing. And it's sort of, you know, it's based on the idea that as the more skilled you become in your chosen field, the less confident you are that you actually know what you're doing and the more you tend to suffer from imposter syndrome. Whereas, you know, the true amateurs or the people just starting out, or the, as it sort of puts it in the article, the genuinely untalented, meanwhile, probably have no idea they're no good because they're too untalented to realize it.
Oh, what's the name of the effect that they call that again?
Dunning-Kruger effect, I think.
Yeah, they did a study. I remember reading about this. Honestly, it sounds like kind of great to be blissfully ignorant, but unfortunately for us, you know, intelligent, talented people, we must suffer.
That's right. Correct.
Just for, again, people playing at home, imposter syndrome, I don't know, do they define it in this piece? It's how would we explain it?
They don't really, you know, it's the sense that, you know, I got away with it again, you know, if I've really got to do a job with this, otherwise, you know, everybody's going to find out what a fraud I am. You know, it's, you know, research shows very common with very successful people, particularly creative people, business people, you know, allegedly Steve Jobs had it, and, you know.
That feeling that they've just sort of like been winging it, that totally. Eventually someone's gonna figure out that they're not that great after all.
Yeah, and the dirty truth is, and I remember seeing an interview with Bill Murray about this where he, and I'm kind of paraphrasing what he was talking about, but, you know, they were like, you know, what's the secret? And he's like, I don't know, like I'm just making it up as I go along. And and that's kind of, and that, you know, for me, that kind of, and I think for most artists and creatives, there's a real sense of that, you know, no matter how good you are at something, you know, the idea of drawing back the curtain and actually showing people the process and your, you know, the way things get made and, you know, the hard slog that it's been to get to where you are is kind of horrifying. And it's really
Do you feel
difficult.
That way at all, Andrew, with your work?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, a lot of the time, you know, like, and I get asked regularly, you know, oh, please, we just want to see your process. Can you teach a class on, you know, how you illustrate in the style you do, or how you sketch, or how you ink your drawings? And, you know, it's a little bit difficult for me because, you know, through True Grit Texture Supply, I do share a lot of my process, and I'm only ever going to show that part of my process. I'm never going to teach people how I illustrate the way I do, because it would be like handing people the guide on how to knock off my work.
Yeah.
So it definitely gets me thinking about, you know, like the other side of that is I would be horrified to show people the way I make absolutely every little aspect of my work, because I don't know, I just, you know, deep down, most artists, it's like, you know, there's no magic talent here. It's like, it's hard work and it's getting things wrong 50 times until it's right. And, you know, unless you are truly talented.
I think we can safely say that you're truly talented, Andrew.
Oh, well, let's say we'll practice. So, yeah, and I mean, you know, what interests me a lot about this article, more so than the idea that, you know, nobody really knows what they're doing and they are just kind of incrementally getting better at things as they go by making mistakes, is you know, some of the commentary or some of the subtext of the article that, you know, talentless people, you know, they're happy to tell everybody how great they are. And to me, I think when you're first starting out, that's actually really important, because if you completely lacked that confidence, you just wouldn't start. And I know I, you know, like when I was first starting, I was so clueless, so utterly clueless. And I would send my portfolio to people that I had no business sending my portfolio to. And I would make things that I thought were the most amazing thing of all time. And, you know, if I looked at it again now, it was just such utter garbage. But I wasn't afraid to embarrass myself and just, you know, reach out to people and reach out to heroes and all that kind of thing. And I think that's important. I mean, I guess my question for you, Jeremy, and Lara as well, like, you guys have, you know, you've nurtured so much talent and you get so many portfolio submissions. Is this a real thing? Have you noticed this? Or, you know, are some people just, you know, truly untalented and you know, they have a megaphone and they're quite happy to let you know how great they are, no matter, you know, what their level of skill?
Oh,
This is so tricky because I kind of think if you come in, when I kind of hear that kind of attitude, I feel like I can't give the feedback that's necessary to kind of grow in that way. It's like, well, this person already kind of has this kind of idea about their work. And I think, you know, what you kind of say here about, you know, this being a necessary kind of quality to propel people over that hump, I think is really kind of important and really true. So I kind of feel that it's hard to really kind of do anything with if someone's kind of at that stage. And usually though, I notice, I just kind of like, I'm a real pure capitalist in this regard where I kind of say, well, let the market respond. You know, if you're
damn
doing
American,
oh well, yeah, if you're doing work and you're putting it out there, like, I don't know how much kind of confidence kind of plays in it. It's interesting. I was just listening to one of my favorite podcasts, the Slate Culture Gabfest, and they were talking about how this whole kind of summer in America has been a lot about all these kind of articles about people who've been conning people. And what's the famous one? The
Anna Delvey.
Yes. Oh my God. Such a crazy story. But it's like, it's interesting.
I think like Jennifer Lawrence is going to play her in the movie.
I think you can, you know, yeah, like, it's amazing like what confidence, you know, how you can use confidence and gain people's confidence and use your own confidence to kind of elevate yourself, like, you know, in this kind of way.
Yeah, we work in advertising and it's a very schmoozy confidence-filled zone.
I've seen a lot of that happen in advertising, but I don't know like if it can happen in artwork so much. Like, I've never seen, and it's so funny, like we do get a lot of submissions where I read every submission that comes through, and people would be like, I've looked at Jackie Winter, I've been illustrated for this major person or this huge client and this thing, and then like I look at the folio, I'm like, what, really?
Yeah.
Either someone's lying, or you know, they actually have gotten this work like through some kind of connection or what, I don't know. It's kind of really weird, but otherwise I don't see how, you know, like the proof is always in the pudding, like in artwork, like it's either kind of there or it's not. And if you get that work, like, you know, great. And I kind of think that's kind of the interesting flip side about what this kind of syndrome is, where it's like, well, the better that you actually get, the more likely that you're going to be working with more talented people and kind of better people. And then that's going to make you feel kind of even more inadequate.
And it's also that you get a better sense of, you understand the flaws or the faults or what is good in artwork or what is bad in artwork, or, you know, and then you are able to judge your work more critically than before. Like, for example, I always think about like how for someone who doesn't play an instrument, let's say you don't play piano, and you watch a pianist, you're kind of amazed by everything they do, but everything might seem just as complicated as, you know, as anything else. Whereas if you do play the piano and you watch someone do something incredibly complicated that might not seem as complicated to other people, you're just like, holy shit, that's incredible. So when you gain more knowledge, you start to critique your work even more intensely.
Have you ever, Laura, been through this with an artist where you've had to kind of coach them through a period like this at all?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I mean, look, it's my job to support the artist, and that involves all manner of things from, you know, sort of the very practical stuff like negotiating contracts or advising them on career development to the sort of, yeah, the more emotional stuff like giving encouragement, making sure they know and feel like I'm sort of their partner in this stuff. And for some artists, although of course not everyone actually needs or even wants this, but it does involve having a sort of real understanding of their personal situations, whether that be mental health, family situation, living conditions, whatever it might be, so that I can sort of better service their own unique needs. But I think the key thing is that always there is a requirement that I should try and understand what each artist individually wants and needs from me. And no matter what, I think my job is never to blindly lead someone into a false sense of brilliance if the work isn't hitting the mark. It's my job to help respectfully and tactfully guide and advise them towards a successful outcome for each project, and in that way sort of nurture their careers. And luckily for me, all of our artists are incredible and their work is amazing. So, you know, when I do sense someone is doubting the strength of their work, it's often just a matter really of investigating why. And like, if there's a reason behind their thinking that the work might not be up to scratch that is valid, well, then I can just sort of help them address it. But it's usually not something that's like a long-term issue, you know. And then, you know, it's my job really to then show their clients why that work is of a certain value. And I guess that's how I help in that regard. But I mean, overall, like I like this piece. I think it's funny though, because although all rational thinking tells me to believe it, I definitely have a hard time actually remembering this in practice. Like I personally feel really confronted by other people's confidence in their ideas. Like I find that a really confronting thing. And it's something I come across a lot. Like I'm always really taken aback by people who feel really comfortable not only in putting their ideas on the table, but asserting them as a great idea. And like, I'm a confident person, no doubt. Like, you know, I think there's a difference though in being confident in how you sort of generally present yourself, like being friendly, feeling comfortable with different types of people, being chatty, whatever, and a difference with that to being genuinely confident in your creative or professional output. That seems like a bizarre luxury for the dazed and confused. Like, I do tend to feel like there's sort of three categories here. Like, there's people who are super doubtful of their work and sort of scared to share it. There's people who are super confident in their work because it is clearly great and it's been validated as so by others. And then there are people who are super confident in their work because they're ignorant and they're unaware of its true standard. And often they're also like straight and white and male, and that can sort of, those things can contribute to an ego that is maybe not necessarily valid. But I think it's funny because you could sort of, you could categorize me, I think, as someone who worries a lot. Jeremy, you might agree. Just rolling your eyes at me. Like, I see the potential downfalls of everything and I nitpick the problems or issues in anything. I'm just presenting a really cool vision of myself here. But you know, it's those things that make me a good fit for production and help make me sort of a strong writer and editor. But it's also like, I think sometimes other people's seemingly like blind confidence completely baffles me, and I cannot understand how they aren't like tearing their own ideas apart with anxious doubt before they even have a chance to sort of, you know, share it with the outside world, like normal people.
I think, yeah, I mean, confidence comes with experience as well. You know, you look at designers like Paul Rand, like, you know, infamously would only present kind of one option to the client, and that's kind of about it. And I think, you know, for artists that are kind of more kind of early to mid-stage career, I think having self-awareness, especially kind of in a much more global marketplace, is so important. Kind of knowing kind of where you are, and that could kind of, even though we're talking about work or, you know, in the creative field, which is inherently subjective, you're never going to have kind of a clear picture of kind of where you are. And that's why I kind of always tell every artist, like, make sure you're always researching and keeping on top of things and knowing what everyone is doing everywhere and what's being commissioned. And then you'll kind of have a better idea of where you fit.
I think, yeah. But as well, like, just touching on that, like, sort of the idea of that naivety in the early days of your career, like, Andrew, as you said before, like, everyone, all three of us definitely can, I'm sure, can look back on work we created as a young sort of like wide-eyed whippersnapper and sort of look at it now with horror over how bad it was and wonder why we were ever sort of so proud of it. And yes, you know, that lack of understanding about the quality, how the quality of your work ranks against others can be valuable, and I guess allowing you the emotional freedom to challenge yourself and put yourself out there before you sort of become bitter and twisted like us. But I think it definitely, if it bleeds too much into ignorance, into a lack of care about improving your practice and learning from those around you, then it's just detrimental to the person themselves and probably even more so for the people around them who have to endure it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've kind of seen both sides of this a little bit too. You know, like, now living in America in particular, in Los Angeles, people are very quick to tell you how great they are.
Oh, yeah, they're not shy.
And it's really funny to kind of, you know, have those conversations with people, and they're like, oh, yeah, I'm an artist. I'm this amazing artist. And, you know, I'm doing this group show soon, blah, 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 blah. And then they kind of, you know, ask you, oh, what do you do, blah, blah. And you're like, oh, yeah, I'm an illustrator, blah, blah, blah. And then, like, at some point they kind of stalk you online, and the next time they see you, it's like, oh my God, I now realize I'm not a real artist. Like, sometimes they actually kind of come out with it, and they're like, oh yeah, like that conversation we had, that was bravado. Like, I now realize that.
But that's such a cultural thing, you know, isn't it, as well? Because it goes so against the Australian sort of humble, like, tall poppy kind of vibe versus the, like, the importance of status, you know. But anyway, look, let's wrap it up.
A lot of good things to get stuck into there. Again, we will put all of these links on our show notes. Before we get into our final section, Andrew, where can people find out more about you, more about True Grit, everything Andrew Fairclough?
Probably just from my website, kindredstudio.net, which has links to everything there, or via my social media, kindred_studio or True Grit Texture Supply.
Excellent. Thank you very much. The time has come to us to apologize to our audience, though. We know you had faith in us. We know you believed in us, and we let you down. I'm sure you will all be shocked, flabbergasted even, but we did not come up with a better name for our closing segment over the break. And so we're back with Thumbs Up / Thumbs Down, the time we dedicate each week to get to the good, bad, and the completely petty off our chest. Why? Because nobody else will listen to us. It's true. So, Laura, get us started. What do you got for us?
Yeah, look, I was thinking about doing something special today, given it is our first show of the new season. And I thought I might start things off with posy vibes and give something a thumbs up. But then I changed my mind. So I've got a thumbs down on behalf of Bianca and Micah here in the office, and also my mother, who are all in the process of looking for a place to rent.
Bianca got a place.
oh, well, I can still complain for her. And it, I mean, the process is a nightmare. Like there's just something, at least in Melbourne, there's something about this time of year where like, you know, every inspection has about like a million bajillion people. And even the ones that have like the kitchen in the bathroom and no roof and like an old Greek man living in the garage, like they're all so expensive and everyone wants them and it's just impossible. And even though it's not me going through it, I'm having like PTSD flashbacks to when I last did. So yeah, thumbs down, thumbs up to a thumbs down to renting.
Andrew, what about you? You got a thumbs up or thumbs down this week?
Oh, look, let's go with thumbs down. And it kind of it relates back to the last article a little bit. Social media, Instagram in particular. If you're trying to get the attention of your hero or a Instagram account that you really want to share your work, the way not to do it is to constantly re-edit your comments on your posts so that every single day those accounts get pinged.
Really, but Andrew, I just want you to talk to me.
Does that actually happen? I think people are so creative how they get around these things.
No, people do it to us as well. We've received those. It's friggin' annoying.
Oh, I don't know what's going on. Has somebody out there written a blog post? I'm like, hey, this is how you get attention on social media. It is infuriating. I guess we're talking two or three times a day from like, you know, probably with, through the Trigger at Texture Supply handle, I probably get this like, three or four times a day from five or six different posters consistently. Where they
Enough followers to understand the experience of being a true celebrity.
Good. Oh my god! Like, and again, you know, like by all means, like put it out there, show your work, but just don't annoy people.
Do it respectfully,
The squeaky wheel does not get the grease in this case.
Jeremy, what about you?
I'm going to wrap up with another link, which is a huge thumbs up for me. Speaking of kind of Instagram, probably my favorite Instagram account at the moment, one that is not updated frequently enough, but it's called Paperback Paradise. Are you familiar with this at all?
No.
Oh my God. Basically,
Googling now.
I was really surprised to see this on Artsy, which is usually a much more kind of high art website, but they actually uncovered, not like, you know, in a bad way, but introduced the actual kind of creator, who is an artist, writer, comedian, Dominic Moschitti. God, I just butchered his surname.
Moschitti.
Moschitti. I don't know if that's a troll or not.
Just getting Mo and Moschitti.
But basically what he does is he takes kind of like kind of 90s books like Sweet Valley Twins or Goosebumps and just kind of re-edits them. They're so funny. I just like, it gives me so much joy, and just being able to, like, he does not update frequently enough, and so getting to read this article and see and be reacquainted with this work.
But there's a few hundred posts, so like if this is the first time you've heard of it, you can have a good like couple hours just scrolling through, because it's hilarious.
You can totally binge on it. I highly recommend. Again, that is Paperback Paradise on Instagram, and that will do it for this week. Thank you so much, Laura.
You are welcome.
Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thanks, guys.
I'm Jeremy Wartzman. She's Laura Chan Baker. And this has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Our theme music is by totally unrelated to our company, Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you want more Jackie Winter Gives You the Business, archives of all of our shows and the links we covered can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. To receive all of the links we talk about on the show each week in one neat little package, you can sign up to our podcast newsletter at tinyletter.com/Jackie Winter. You can also find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And you can hit us up with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. If you love what you hear, you can really help us out by subscribing, rating, and leaving us a comment on iTunes. And of course, recommending us to all your friends and family. As well as iTunes, they can get the show wherever you get podcasts, including Spotify and Stitcher, or for the traditionalists, directly from our website, which is, again, jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Remember that this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using Pocket Cast, Overcast, or Castro podcatchers, you'll be able to see the links to the articles as we're talking about them, as well as other schmick visual content as we rabbit on. It's like we're right in the room with you. And if you work for an advertising agency or design studio and are interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.rodeo for more info. Thank you very much for listening. We will catch you next week. Bye. Bye. Bye.